Hello, I'm Robin Ince, and welcome to this, an Amnesty International podcast. Over the next few weeks, I'm going to be talking to some well-known comedians as we get closer to this year's Secret Policeman's Ball. Today, I'm here at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and I am with Mr. Stuart Lee, the comedian, the writer, the director, the columnist, both for magazines which are still alive and those which have died as well, without paying you, I
believe. Many which have finished without paying me, yeah.
And what are you doing? You've been to the Fringe Festival too often now. This must be 20 years, isn't it?
I think it's 22. I think it's 22 years, but I can't quite remember now. And this year I'm doing a stand-up show, which isn't really a proper show, because I'm trying to work out stuff for doing a telly thing next year. And it's advertised as such. All the publicity says, work in progress, old material and new material, notes towards a television project in huge letters. But I still made the mistake of doing a Robin Ince-like thing and looking on the internet at what people were saying, and they were saying things like, it was as if he'd never done some of it before, or this bit was old, or you'd think he would have worked it out in previews. So I've been doing that, and that's been all right. And then I've got a little theatre piece on that I've written called Elizabeth and Riley Lateman Live.
And that's with Simon Munnery. With Simon Queen Munnery Elizabeth the First.
As Queen Elizabeth
the First. Who looks fantastic,
yeah, he does look
I
really
think.
Good, yeah, yeah.
I think he would look better more often in Tudor regalia.
Basically, if you want him to do those things, you have to trick him by getting him to dress up as Elizabeth I. Or last year, I got him to dress up as a kind of weird version of Samuel Johnson. So, yeah, he's been great. I mean, he sort of worked rather better as Samuel Johnson than as Elizabeth I. But even Elizabeth I, good, because, I mean, she's famous for making all these, you know, really pithy statements and great speeches, and that's what his material's like. And you can kind of mash them together a bit. And with Johnson, when he was Samuel Johnson for me last year, you really couldn't tell what was Simon Munnery and what was Samuel Johnson. With Queen Elizabeth, it's rather more obvious where we've tinkered with it. Queen Elizabeth did say, the body of a weak and feeble woman, I have the heart and stomach of a king. But she didn't say, and also the brain of an eagle and the penis of a hippopotamus. And all I need now is some glue. That's very much Simon added on.
That's because I think Simon's little book, How to Live, I think it's called, which I think it was Simon actually said that years ago there was this guy who would come up to him at gigs that he thought was a bit weird.
Yeah.
And he went, I really like what you do, Simon. I've spray painted one of your lines on a wall.
Yeah.
And he's gone, oh, right, brilliant. It was just some lunatic. And then the bloke kept coming up to him. And then about the fourth time, someone went, you know that bloke? That's that bloke Banksy. And it was like, what? This is now probably one of the wealthiest graffiti artists in the world.
Yeah. Well, Banksy put that book out for him. Banksy was a real fan of Simon's stuff, and he does spray up a lot of his things. And when you buy the Banksy books, which must have sold a lot of copies, you know, you see Simon's lines like, many are prepared to suffer for their art, but few are prepared to learn how to draw, for example, is up. And then Banksy uses him in an attempt to preserve his anonymity when he went to the States. He took Simon with him, and Simon was supposed to pretend to be Banksy's manager and answer press conference calls and stuff like that, which I expect just was designed quite deliberately to make everything more confusing, you know, knowing that you wouldn't really get a straight answer out of him.
You have got a bit, as you were saying, you're doing Edinburgh this year to prepare for a TV show. You have a big, what's it, six-part BBC Two TV series?
Well, yeah, it's amazing. It's been 11 years since I ever did anything. I did things for telly in the mid-90s with Richard Herring, and I don't think we really appreciated quite how lucky we were, because when we looked around us, there were quite a lot of people doing odd things on telly at the time. Like, there was Reeves and Mortimer in The Fast Show and Steve Coogan and all the kind of things that people of our generation thought were good. And it didn't seem the sort of inaccessible citadel that it does now with hundreds of layers of bureaucratic madness involved. It did seem like a kind of you go and do something and someone might go, oh, try that out. But I think we were probably incredibly deluded and ungrateful and didn't realise how lucky we were to be doing it on the back of three or four radio series. But anyway, I am doing a series BBC Two next year, and it's been 4 years in preparation. Initially, I was asked to go for a meeting with BBC Two, and they said, you're great, what do you want to do? And I said, 6 half-hours of stand-up. And they went, get on with it, it won't be a problem. And then it was a problem. And it got stopped, and then it went down to being, you had to do a pilot, and then it went down to, I had to do a 15-minute pilot, and then it went down to nothing. And then about 18 months ago, it came back on the slate, and we did a pilot, and it went really well. So, you know, the series is happening now, which is really, really great. So I think it should be both be easier and better than anything I've done before, hopefully.
But it is. I've seen the pilot, and the odd. I am almost surprised that it has been commissioned because there's no angle. And that's no. And this is the thing we're talking about, this obsession that television has with what's the angle. And you go, well, the one that is, keeps sticking in my mind is the fact that, you know, they go, we should do a new variety show for young people, but we need some kind of angle. What kind of angle is there? Well, imagine if there was a wall in the middle of the studio and it occasionally talked. Well, everyone wants to see an occasionally talking wall in between some character acts and a musician guest. That's what they want to see. Daniel Bedingfield, a talking wall, and then a bloke pretending to be someone common.
Right. I mean, there isn't a unique selling point for it. There isn't an angle. I think that's probably why it went away in the first place, because it's just me talking and then there's some sketches. And I suppose the angle is that one would like to imagine that all comedians have a different and unique tone of voice and point of view, and that's sort of the angle of it. But there isn't. It's not happening like in space, and there's no hidden camera, and it's not all the sketches aren't about transport or anything like that. So I really think when I looked at the pilot, I thought, well, this would never have got made unless it was for the fact that for the last 4 years, you know, I've had really good reviews. So I think it's sort of, I think I'm in this position where I seem like an asset to a broadcaster. And I even people that haven't heard of me, I think, are going, oh, you're doing something with Stuart Lee. Well, he's very good, of course. I've never seen him, but I've heard he's marvellous. So I think I'm just in that phase, and that will change. And in fact, you know, looking at the looking in a Robin Ince-like way at all the internet reviews this year, that it is like, that is the start of the backlash. You know, and so I think I may have ducked it for a year by not really doing a big show. But I think, yeah, and also the other thing that will happen is all the people that only like you because no one. I mean, I've got about 5,000 people that like me, and that's as long as you're
that's
not
using
with
MySpace, of course, yeah, as the idea of
well,
yeah,
I mean,
and
how many people go and see me in a year? You know, and actually, that if as long as you haven't got a promoter stealing all the money, you kind of that's a living, you know. But a lot of those 5,000 people will be the kind of people that, if I get on telly, will not like me anymore. And so they shouldn't. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, I was thinking, since you've got older now and you have a child, and you would imagine that, you know, you might swing to the right because that's, you know, what we often expect. And if anything, your stand-up has become more politically passionate, I think. It's certainly, since you've come back... you know, there was a cynical sarcasm and yeah, deconstruction in your old stand-up. But now you do seem to be fired up a lot by...
Well, I think it's just things that have happened to you. Like, first of all, when doing Jerry Springer the Opera made me think a lot about, well, two things. One is this kind of assumption that... my experiences working on that made me think about this kind of assumption that it happens in every area of life now, that something's only operating at its best if every last possible ounce of profit has been squeezed out of it. And so that tended to, you know, have a knock-on effect about how I did other things subsequently. And the other thing, of course, was like being involved in a whole debate around that, about what you can and can't say and freedom of speech and whatever. And it made me think about how these kind of things hang by threads a bit. And I was kind of lucky, really, because when I gave up stand-up for a bit in 2000, 2001, it was kind of because I had nothing to talk about. And yet doing Jerry Springer the Opera and, like, having to go around the country sort of defending it when people were trying to ban it kind of fired me up again and made me realise that there are important things to talk about. But can you do it in a funny way? And the other thing, I think, that happened in the time I had off was there was a sort of wave of people that came along. Well, like Daniel Kitson came to fruition and Josie Long started. And I remember seeing Boothby Graffo a few times during that period as well, and seeing people that were as funny as all the cynical comedians that I thought I was and that I liked in my 20s and early 30s, but they were talking about things that they liked or offering hope and things like that. And I thought, oh, I wonder if there's some way of doing that, you know, because people always... When people talk about Bill Hicks, for example, they say, oh, he's a cynic. But he doesn't seem like a cynic to me. He seems like a defeated romantic, which is a slightly different thing. So I wondered if there was a way of bringing in an element of defeated romance rather than cynicism into the whole thing. And I certainly think the last two shows did that.
Well, there is. I was going to bring up the fact, talking before about passionate stand-up and politics. If you do any politics in your stand-up, there will be people who go, "Well, how's that going to change anything?" But you go, "Well, politics is still just a subject."
Yeah, it's just
So, you know, people doing cock gags or gags about wanking, people go, "Do you know what? That bloke's been in 20 years of wanking gags, and the style of wanking still hasn't changed in the country.
Yeah,
it's about time we stopped having these kind of jokes."
Yeah, but then things go in and out of fashion. I mean, things go in and out of fashion. I think that there was, although weirdly there was a right-wing government in, I think in the world of like comedy and the arts in the 80s, there was a kind of liberal consensus, you know. And now it's more difficult to know exactly how things are going to play. And I was watching Richard Sandling's show the other night. He's a guy, he runs a video shop in Southend and talks about that. We did about 20 minutes in the middle of it about his experience of racism at work and people's kind of stupid attitudes towards immigration. And four people in the front row got out and left. Now, it may have been that it wasn't, like, fully formed and it wasn't quite funny enough, but it did look like a kind of protest walkout. And something that wouldn't have happened 20 years ago when we started is there just wouldn't have been BNP voters in an audience in a comedy club. Whereas, I mean, at Leicester 2 years ago, I remember Shappy Corsandi was on stage at Jongleurs in Leicester doing jokes about the BNP. From the point of view of a non-white person, and the BNP supporters in the audience went and complained to the management that they didn't expect to come out and have their views insulted, you know, and like that just would never have happened in a comedy club a couple of years ago. And this is slightly one of my worries about the comedy festival, right? These four big venues have sheared off from the fringe and called themselves the Edinburgh Comedy Festival because they say that people don't appreciate what a brilliant month it is here and how great all the comedy is. And if only we could get some more marketing money from a sponsor, we could tell everyone about it and loads more people would come. Now, I don't know if I want loads more people to come because I expect that Tallinn and Prague and Dublin thought it was really great when the EasyJet flights opened and there was all this money coming in from English stag parties. But now all those cities are awash with English vomit and all the women have become prostitutes, right? And I kind of think they were really nice before. And I kind of think the fringe is really nice. And do we actually want the kind of people that would come to the Smirnoff, Carling, Red Bull comedy festival marketed all over the country? We probably don't. And what it would probably mean is that comics wouldn't be able to do as interesting material because there'd be a Stag Night mentality or a Comedy Store or a Jongleurs mentality about what people should be seeing. And at the moment, there's this weird enclave. Whatever people say about it being over-commercialised and whatever, it's still a place where people can actually do what they want. And they can normally find an audience that want to see it. And they don't have to be responsible to the sponsors or the promoters or whatever. But they would be in an Edinburgh Comedy Festival. And I think it would change, you know, who came. And I think, you know, it might have that feeling like you have when you go to Prague now and you just see puke everywhere and prostitutes and go, "Oh, you should have come 10 years ago, it's great." And I think, like, that might be what happens, but it might be just a paranoia. But again, it's that feeling of, it's so brilliant here, we should tell everyone about it and make more people come and make it bigger. Why? Why should you do that? The only reason to do that is to make more money out of it. What's the point? It's really great, just leave it alone.
It's like the secret pub you won't tell anyone about, which you're quite right.
Well, it's closed down, actually.
Oh, has it?
Yeah. Well, no one was going, you know.
Right, yeah, well, that's your fault. Stuart Lee, no, I don't want anyone to know about my secret pub. You've got what you deserve. But there is, when you talk, I arrived on the Saturday, and, you know, when you go down Cowgate, there are the stags and the hens. I think many of them are just coming to Edinburgh anyway.
Oh, they don't know about
that. But there are others who go. Sometimes seems to be this kind of, there's a lot of macho stand-up. There's a lot of, you know, certainly in publicity and in newspapers, there's a lot of people who, it seems to me that liberal journalists go, well, I mean, it's great to see this because, as we know, no one is homophobic or misogynistic or racist anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's nice to see someone holding a mirror up to us and talk about how much they'd like to punch a woman in the tits until, you know, they bled. But I think, well, the world hasn't changed that much. And yet, if anyone, there are a lot of people who are doing more liberal things. People go, boring, want to hear more about what actually previously would have been a shorter one-liner thing that would have been in a club, working man's club.
Yeah.
We want to hear that now espoused for a long time.
Well, I think I know what you mean, but I also think it's difficult to make generalisations about that because when you go and see Sadovitz, he does all those things that you're talking about not liking, but he does them.
I'm not saying not like him. What I'm saying is that there's a kind of a macho posturing, whereas, you know, Sadovic ultimately the self-loathing within.
Self-loathing changes it. I mean, it's difficult to know how these things read out of context without actually seeing them in the whole act. But I mean, there is a fairly wide spread. I mean, I think there's things that happen now that you just wouldn't have ever had on a circuit gig 20 years ago. I remember David Baddiel comparing at Orangey Boom, and I think Jerry Sadovitz was on. Orangey Boom was a little club in Chinatown in London, and I think Sadovitz used the word and David went and apologised afterwards to the audience for them hearing this, which would have been about 1990. And yet, of course, within 5 years, if you could blame the shift towards thuggism in society on one person, it would be him. Making football and porn acceptable.
Who do you have any specific inspirations when you, over your 22 years, whatever you've been doing, stand-up?
Well, I think with comedy, right, there was one guy I saw in 1984, who I always gone about, Ted Chippington, I saw him opening for The Fall when I was a teenager, and it was sort of, and it was a bit like Ed Axel now, you know, it was like anti-comedy, no jokes. And I thought it was like the coolest thing I'd ever seen. But subsequent to that, when I was here in 1987, there was one particular show I saw, which was Arthur Smith introducing a bill, which was Arnold Brown, Jerry Sadovitz and Norman Lovett. And I thought it was absolutely superb. And I actually think that the whole matrix of like everything I did for the first 5 years I was doing stand-up is like them plus Ted Chippington. You know, really, just the trying to do some of the sort of shock of Sadovitz with the calmness of all those other acts, you know. And I think I was really lucky that I was... If I'd seen any other bill, I think I would have thought, God, I could never do stand-up. It's men shouting and running around fast and in, you know. And whereas I think I'm really lucky that the first bill I saw of stand-ups was kind of grumpy and lugubrious, which is sort of what I was like. So I kind of thought I could probably do that. I think it was just a bit of luck, really. And I think probably that those people would be... coincidentally, the first people I saw, but also just by sheer luck, the people that were most like anything I'd want to do.
I was going
to
go back briefly as well, because you didn't go to Glastonbury this year because you went, it's all rubbish. And then I rang you, I can't remember who I'd just seen, and you went, oh, it actually sounds quite good.
It did sound
but
good.
It did, politically again, I found it very interesting this year. Maybe it's because I hung around the left field tent. But overall, I got this sense that there were a lot of people who, they were kind of united, also in the fact that a lot of people didn't go to Glastonbury, oh, it's going to be rainy again. And so the people who did come were quite diehard. And they were, you know, Tony Benn was on and Billy Bragg and trade union leaders and talking about, you know, banana plantation, all manner of things that were going on. And I did seem to see that there was a passion about politics. And I was going to ask you, we've talked about inspirational comedians, but is there anyone politically or anyone as a writer that you would go, you can read an essay and go, oh, that's...
Well, politically... not really anymore. I mean, I really like it when you see those Tony Benn live tours. But I just think it's such a different landscape now to the one we grew up in. Again, I mean, you hate sounding like an old fart, but when we grew up, in the 80s, Michael Foot was the leader of the Labour Party, and Michael Foot was scruffy and wore a duffel coat. But in between the First and Second World War, Michael Foot volunteered to go to fight fascism in Spain. He actually volunteered for a war that he didn't have to be in to go and fight for something he believed in. And I don't think there's a single person in British politics today who could imagine actually putting their own life at risk over something they believed in. Just no way, you know. So I think it is hard. So as usual, you're sort of inspiration from the past.
In places like Burma, comedians can be arrested and incarcerated for a long period of time for doing some gags. Now, do you think that means that we should make sure that we take, if you want to anyway, risks and say what we really believe in, because we as yet can only be censored by not being placed on television or radio or gaining any publicity from the local newspapers and therefore only playing to 12 people in Rotherham Library Theatre Bar.
There's a tendency now for these odd shows get promoted as like say the unsayable, and people go, hey, we're having, particularly in America, they go, we're having Nasty Night. Come down to the Nasty Show and you can say whatever you want. And I always think, well, Greg Fleet was talking to me about this, and then he said, well, we can say whatever we want anyway. Why do we need to go to, like, an event where we're told we have to? And that really makes you think that, yeah, you are allowed. You can say whatever you want. And all that can happen to stop you saying whatever you want is enough people go, don't say that, and go, and don't watch it. And you never get to perform. But I think that when you read about comics in those countries getting put in prison, you realise what a luxury that is. And probably that if you are going to say what you want, you have a responsibility to research it a bit and at least know what you're talking about. And, because in other places, people are made to justify their position and be accountable for it, whereas here we're just allowed to say anything. I think it is it's a right that's been hard won, and it was always a struggle going on quietly by people like Amnesty, even here, to maintain it. And so we're very lucky to be able to do it, but I also think you have to think, why am I saying this?
Everyone has a duty to their community. What do you consider yours to be? And what's your community, actually?
Well, I was thinking about this recently, and I was thinking, like, where we live in London, everything's at breaking point, and everyone's really stressed out, and Hackney Council's, like, falling apart. And I thought, oh, I should just leave. And then I thought, no, I'm exactly the sort of person that should stay, because I can write letters and complain about things. So I'm trying to figure out now what my community is and what my duty to it is. I don't really know whether it's to stay and struggle and improve everyone's standard of living by association, or just to go, oh, God, I've had enough, and leave and go and live in a wood.
Do you have a favourite comedy sketch?
Well, my favourite bit of comedy on TV is when Father Ted... has to look through the window at the Chinese people waving at them, and there's a black mark that makes him look like he's dressed up as Hitler. That, for me, that's my Del Boy falling through the bar, and I must have watched that 30 or 40 times. I think it's great.
Everyone's entitled to a nationality. If you could choose another, what would it be?
Probably Irish, if I could have a second nationality, yeah.
Why?
Well, they seem so harmless, you know. I mean, it's a bit embarrassing being British at the moment, isn't it? Because you're basically the second most hated country in the world because we were associated with America. And I don't think anyone realises that. I don't think anyone's quite aware of how badly it comes across whenever we now try and give advice to other countries about how they should be behaving in an ethical way, when we're... apologists for Guantanamo and facilitating all those torture flights, and also going into a war that the UN didn't agree with. But I think I'd like to be Irish, because wherever Irish people go in the world, they seem to be welcomed as sort of ambassadors of a kind of leprechaun style goodwill. So yeah, probably that.
Thank you to Stuart Lee. To see lots more comedians supporting Amnesty at the Secret Policeman's Ball on the 4th of October, or see it on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. on Sunday, October the 5th. And for more information about the Secret Policeman's Ball and Amnesty International, log on to www.protectthehuman.com.